know what happened next.
Yes.
We stopped at Mandaka being born.
That's right, and that's exactly where we're going to take off. And it's good that you're here, you know, that from the very beginning. That's good.
So it was Mandaka, right? Who was also called Indravaha because
that's right.
Indra.
Yeah. On the rump.
Yes.
Is that?
Yes. Okay.
No. He was the one who was born from the side of.
Wasn't he also the one who sat on Indra, or was it his father Yuvanaswa? I was just thinking about it on the way
down. I'll summarize. I'll have a look. We'll just, yeah. I like to summarize because that helps you to remember. Yeah.
Because I remember the Bikupsi and the Ishwaku story quite well. But then I kind of forgot after Yuvanaswa and Mandaka what happened in the sense of who was the one who sat on Indra. Was it the father or the son?
But that, you know, that's wanted. It's wanted that, you know, that's Krishna consciousness, that we've got so many things to think about related to Krishna that it takes up our whole life. And they're very, very enjoyable. You know, it's natural. It's almost like it pops into our head automatically. There's no, you know, there's no great austerity in one sense. So, so let's see. So we got up to
we read about Mandaka.
Yes.
Being born and then not getting the milk, and then Indra came down to give him his thumb.
Yes, and we got up to verse 38, that Mandata begot three sons in the womb of Bindumati, the daughter of Sasabindu. These sons were Purukutsa, Ambarish, and Muchukunda, a great mystic yogi. These three brothers had 50 sisters who all accepted the great sage Salvari as their husband. So that's where we're up to. And this Mandata, of course, he gave immense charity to the brahmanas, performed yajna to worship the Lord. It says all the places from where the sun rises on the horizon to where it sets are known as the possession of Mandata, the son of Yuvanashva. So,
he caused
fear for Ravana and other thieves and rogues who caused anxiety, and thus he was known as Trasadasu, a name given by Indra, and he became emperor of the whole world, consisting of the seven islands, without a second ruler. So Yuvanashva, his wives couldn't bear him a child, so the brahmanas worshipped Indra in that jagya, and Mandata was born from the lower side of his abdomen. So then going back a little bit in the dynasty, there was a few forefathers back.
Yeah, that was Ishwaku.
Yeah.
They were Bikupsi.
Yeah. Yeah, and he had different names according to his different activities. Yeah.
Okay. today we start with Mandata's three
songs. Yes, Mandata.
$50.
Yep. So we've got the three sons of Mandata. We got that these three brothers had 50 sisters, and their 50 sisters accepted Sobari as their husband. So then text number 39 and 40. Subari Rishi was engaged in austerity deep in the water of the river Jamuna when he saw a pair of fish engaged in sexual affairs. Thus he perceived the pleasure of sex life. So, you know, this word perceived. Perceived is when we're thinking about something, so it's sort of like it's reminded us of something, and then we've conceptualized something in our mind like that. So it may not necessarily been just the fish, but it's sort of then one thought leads to another, and next thing you know, there's all this going on in his mind. And induced by this desire, he went to King Mandata and begged for one of the king's daughters. In response to this request, the king said, "O Brahmana, any of my daughters may accept any husband according to her personal selection." Now, in the purport here, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti the core, Srila Prabhupada is quoting that Mandata was the king of Mathura, and Subari Rishi was engaged in austerity while submerged deep within the river Jamuna. When the Rishi felt sexual desire, he emerged from the water and went to King Mandata to ask that one of the king's daughters become his wife. Subari Muni thought, "I am now feeble because of old age. My hair has become grey, my skin is slack, and my head always trembles. Besides, I am a yogi. Therefore, women do not like me. Since the king has thus rejected me, I shall reform my body in such a way as to be desirable even to celestial women, what to speak of the daughters of worldly kings." So here you see, you know, in the Vedic age, because you mentioned last time that, was it Amber? Ambalika and Ambika, united with Vyasadeva. Who are the three that united with? Pandu.
Yeah.
And Dhritarashtra.
Yeah.
Dhritarashtra.
Yeah. So they had three sons: Pandu, Dhritarashtra, and Vidur.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. And one turned
blind.
And
she closed her eyes. The other one felt sick, and so she had a sickly Pandu.
Who was very white. Yeah,
yes,
very
and
pale.
And she had the third son was from the servant, but
yeah.
The servant was actually
yes.
Took it as a like a.
Yes.
She was happy about it.
Yes.
And so she had Vidur.
She had Vidura. Yeah.
Blessed.
And. Now, I can't remember the story, but did they willingly or unwillingly accept to do that and then realize that, oh, this wasn't what I expected?
It
wasn't what I expected.
It was actually Vichitravirya who was the husband. He
yeah.
passed away without having children.
Yes.
And the older brother who was strong, I think his name was, he was killed by this Gandharva of his same name.
Yes.
And so there was no heirs left to the family.
Yeah.
So then she said, because the husband has died,
yes.
there is a rule that you're allowed to be with the brother
yes.
to begate a child.
Yeah.
And at that time, these women thought that Bhishma will come. And
right.
Bhishma was considered
right.
to be attractive and manly.
Yes.
But instead, Vedvyas
right.
because he was also her son, but
yeah.
nobody knew about this.
Mm.
Even Bhishma didn't know
yeah.
until she said, "I had a son with
yeah.
some,
right.
the name of some big pre something I forget his name. But he was quite mystically, and he was the father of Vedas. And so she
Parasaram.
It was something with B. I forget his name. But he's they meet on the boat, and then he says, "I must have a child now because the timing is right, and then that baby will be Ved Vyas, who will write all the Vedas in the future."
It's Satyavati.
I forget. Yes, so that's the late the monk.
That's it. Yeah.
We're talking about who was the muni, Bhardwaj or something.
Parasaram.
Yeah, so that's right. So then they have the kid, but she hasn't told anyone about Ved Vyas. And that's why when Ved Vyas comes in and they see him, and because he had been meditating, he wasn't even clean, he was they were just pretty appalled by that.
Yeah, so in other words, they went willingly, but they then realized at the last point that, and you know, so Vedic culture was like that. It wasn't, you see here also with Sabari, who was also not very attractive.
Yeah.
And so the king, he's not going to allow anyone to force the situation, even for a great yogi like that. So, you know, he's saying they will marry who they choose.
Yeah.
So, arranged marriages, there is arranged marriages in the Vedic system, but properly done, the arranged marriage is still has to be consented to by the daughter, generally. That's the proper. Unless, you know, someone's forceful by nature and doesn't abide by that. But generally, in Vedic culture, there is arranged marriage, but still the daughter will consent. But that changed, you know, over the course of time. Was done by force, and now we have the dowry system and, you know, so many things like that. So so we had a discussion that, and I was thinking about what you said, and I thought, as far as I understand, it wasn't forced, you know.
No, but I don't know if they had the right to say no if they didn't agree.
Yeah, they did. They did. There was... they still had, you know, so they still had to, you know, the women had the right to consent. In the case of Rukmini, her older brother had arranged that she would marry Sisipal.
Yes.
And she didn't agree, so she arranged for another Kshatriya, who happened to be Krishna, to kidnap her.
Yeah.
She had the Swayambara, and she had the right to choose.
Yes.
And she arranged the ceremony in such a way that certain people would automatically be cut out, because she knew what she was doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was leeway there for a girl to actually accept. They were choosing between suitable persons, but amongst them they still were able to manage to make the choice amongst those that they wanted. So there's arranged marriage, well, here are all the potential ones, but still, you know, there's the law of attraction is part of it. Even astrologically, in the astrological scriptures, basically it's there that by Parasara Muni, the Hara Shastra, that if the boy and the girl actually have a very strong attraction, so that's, he's not saying it's just this last, you know, like they have modern days, but, you know, they really feel a compatibility and a soul connection, then that overrides the astrological factors. See? So even you're doing the, you know, that's considered, that's enough. Yeah. So, you know, even in the scriptures, that's there. So, I remember you said that, and I thought, No, I don't think, you know, when I thought,
yeah,
it's not
as...
Yeah,
you have to think of it, because when she asks him to do it again,
yeah,
she says, no, I'm not comfortable,
yeah,
the second time. And then she sends her servant, and
yeah,
that's how Vidhu responds. So they must,
yeah,
have had the right to say no.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's leeway there for the girls. So Sabari thought, Muni thought, I am now feeble because of old age. My hair is, so we read that one, yeah. So he says, I shall reform my body in such way as to be desirable even to celestial women, what to speak of the daughters of worldly kings. So even Sabari Muni is a great yogi, and, you know, he's even understanding. So he's a very detached yogi, but he's understanding, you know, I have to act in such a way that, you know, there has to be the natural attraction. You know, that has to be there. You can't just because it's Vedic culture that we override, you know, all natural tendencies. So he's even thinking in that way, that it's better if there's a natural, you know, tendency for them to be attracted. So he's also thinking in that way, and the father's thinking in that way, and it ends up the girls are thinking, when they do see him, then they say, yes, okay, that's they're attracted. So thereafter, when Sabari Muni became quite a young and beautiful person, the messenger of the palace took him inside the residential quarters of the princesses, which were extremely opulent. All 50 princesses then accepted him as their husband, although he was only one man. So then, you know, then they even started quarrelling. Oh, he's mine. Thereafter, the princesses, being attracted by Sabari Muni, gave up their sisterly relationship and quarrelled among themselves, each one of them contending, this man is just suitable for me and not for you. In this way, there ensued a great disagreement. Because Sabari Muni was expert in chanting mantras perfectly, his severe austerities resulted in an opulent home with garments, ornaments, properly dressed and decorated maidservants and manservants, and varieties of parks with clear water, lakes and gardens. In the gardens, fragrant with varieties of flowers, birds chirped and bees hummed, surrounded by professional singers. Sabari Muni's home was amply provided with valuable beds, seats, ornaments and arrangements for bathing, and there were varieties of sandalwood creams, flower garlands and palatable dishes. Thus surrounded by opulent paraphernalia, the Muni engaged in family affairs with numerous wives. So we see here that, you know, in Vedic culture, as far as one is able to, they should actually provide the proper setting for the dealings between husband and wife and family, as far as one is able to do. And he was such a yogi that he was able to, you know, do that for 50 women, that they're all, you know, satisfied with the arrangements that he had made.
So how did he change his body?
He's a yogi.
His mystic power was using it all to make the palace and to become young. I think that's how he fell, isn't it? Like from his, because he used up all his mystic power for achieving that desire.
So it says here in the purport that Sabari Muni exhibited super excellence in material enjoyment by dint of his yogic perfection. Bhav Richa means expert in chanting mantras. As material opulence can be achieved by ordinary material means, it can also be achieved by subtle means through mantras. By chanting mantras, Sabari Muni arranged for material opulence, but this was not perfection in life, as will be seen. Sabari Muni became dissatisfied with material opulence and thus left everything and re-entered the forest in the Vanaprastha order and achieved final success. Those who are not atmatattvavit, who do not know the spiritual value of life, can be satisfied with external material opulences. But those who are atmatattvavit, are not inspired by material opulence. This is the instruction we can derive from the life and activities of Subhari Muni. So, of course, you know, this ninth canto, which, you know, deals with the subject matter of liberation. That's the title of the whole ninth canto, is liberation. And, you know, we've heard of, King Sujumna became a woman, and we heard of the marriage of Sukanya and Chavan Muni, another yogi, who also changed his body, and we've heard of Devasa Muni, another great yogi. We heard how actually a devotee is more powerful than actually is a greater yogi, has greater mystic potency than even the greatest of yogis, because they're protected by Yogeshwara, or the personality of Godhead. So because Krishna himself, a devotee doesn't try to get mystic powers for himself, either to enjoy or for any purpose, and he understands that the Lord has all mystic powers, and the Lord is his friend, so they don't require their own set of mystic powers. And sometimes they're taken as less, but we've seen that in the case of Devasa Muni, that Devasa Muni was very much embarrassed when he challenged Ambarish Maharaj. And so one has to be very careful. And we also see that Devasa Muni, although not acting according to gross sex desire, but this subtle sex desire of profit, adoration and distinction. Devasa was actually jealous of Ambarish. He wanted the distinction of being better, greater. You know, why is this king getting so much praise? Here I am, a great yogi, and so much attention is on this Ambarish, like that. So that's actually subtle sex desire. And then now we're hearing about Subhari Muni, and of course we'll also hear the pastimes of Lord Ramchandra, which are also centered around, liberation from lusty desires, as we see that Ravana personifies, the lusty demon. So, in one sense, there's a little bit of Ravana in each of us. And a little bit of Supanika, perhaps. But, this ninth canto is called liberation. Liberation means we're liberated when we have no material desires. And so, you see that theme running through the different stories that we're reading here. Now, therefore, atmatattva-vit, those who know the value of spiritual life, learning from the ninth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, they understand there is no happiness with enjoying external material opulences, either on the subtle mental platform or the gross physical platform. And this is the instruction that we're getting here also with Subhari Muni. So, Mandata, the king of the entire world, consisting of seven islands, was struck with wonder when he saw the household opulence of Subhari Muni, Thus, he gave up his false prestige in his position as emperor of the world. So it says here that in the purport, everyone is proud of his position, but there was an astounding experience in which the emperor of the entire world felt himself defeated in all details of material happiness by the opulence of Subhari Muni. So we can understand how much expertly and powerfully Subhari Muni, the great yogi, could arrange to enjoy with his 50 wives, pleasures of husband and wife and family life, and that the emperor of the entire world was embarrassed with what he was trying to enjoy. What a fool I am, and just gave it all up. So that gives us an idea of what Subhari Rishi did. In this way, Subhari Muni enjoyed sense gratification in the material world, but he was not at all satisfied. Just as fire never ceases blazing if constantly supplied with drops of fat. We see that in the Bhagavad Gita as well, that Krishna says this lust, the eternal enemy of the living entity burns like fire and never satisfied. And here is these Puranas expand that understanding. And from this we can understand that one may think, read the Bhagavad Gita says, we have these material desires that can never be satisfied, and someone may think, a lot of people may have difficulty, but I think I've got a way that I can do it. So then you read these stories of Subhari Muni, and then you realise, no, even if I get that far, which I never will. So, George Harrison, he once said that what people are searching for in this world, I have it. They want opulence. I've got so much wealth. They want fame. I have so much fame. Whatever they're searching for in this world, I have it. And believe me, there is no happiness there. Chant Hare Krishna. So... Thereafter, and Prabhupada explains here, the Western countries have reached the summit of material civilization, but people are still dissatisfied. So that's how we bring it back to, we see, and of course now we know that India is, they're off to the moon, they'll find no satisfaction. What's it? Did it? Oh, yeah. What happened? I saw it in the news that they were going, so they've already failed.
No, it was one today.
Yeah. One today? What happened?
It went almost there.
Yeah.
It was orbiting, I think, in the closest orbit.
Yeah.
And it was about a few kilometers away from the moon.
Yeah.
Then lost connection. Connection from the Earth.
Right, so a little bit more space junk out there for someone to clean up. The scientists say, because everyone says, we're putting so much junk here. The scientists say, these will be wonderful things to find in thousands of years' time. People will, treasure them, all these bits of space junk. Look at this from, so many. That's their story. But people will find them, and as we're seeing here, no happiness. And therefore, of course, the peace formula is that, mentioned Bhagavad Gita 5:29, the sages knowing me as the ultimate purpose of all sacrifices and austerities, or the real enjoyer, the supreme lord of planets and demigods, so the actual proprietor of everything, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attain peace from the pangs of material miseries. So if we actually want peace from the, material desires, we must understand our eternal relationship with the Supreme and interact on that level, then there is peace. So one must therefore take to Krishna consciousness and advance in Krishna consciousness by properly following the regulatory principles. Then one can attain an eternal blissful life in peace and knowledge. Now, of course, Prabhupada says here one must take to Krishna consciousness and advance by properly following the rules of the regulative principles. So, of course, you know, in 1968, Srila Prabhupada was in Los Angeles, and he was saying in a lecture on the Bhagavad Gita that he said, yes, there are rules and regulations, but I've barely given you 1%. he said, otherwise, you wouldn't be able to follow. He said, but according to the principle of Rupa Goswami, which is what we follow, the main thing is somehow or another just become attached to Krishna. You know, hear about Krishna, chant about Krishna, take Krishna Bhishadam, go to the festival. Because you become attached to Krishna. So just like we're hearing Bhagavatam and we become attached to the stories rather than other things which are all nonsense and disturbing. And he said, you know, in time the rules and regulations will all follow naturally like that. But the main thing is just somehow or another try and develop your attachment to Krishna.
All the other material desires, which are like, we think they are material, but they are also like part of Krishna.
All the other material desires?
Yeah.
They're part of Krishna?
Yeah.
In what way?
That means like, Krishna has created everything. That means the whatever desire we come, that is also comes from Krishna as well, no?
Well, because we're part and parcel of Krishna, we have a tendency to desire. so that comes from Krishna. But what happens is that our desires, when they're covered by ignorance, we're desiring something which is causes us to suffer. You know, we desire something which disconnects us from our natural blissful life. So desire is natural. So for instance, you have a Mahesh Yogi and different people, and they say that, desire is sacred. So walk on sacred ground. You know, because it's coming from you and you're spiritual, therefore it's natural, then fulfill those desires. And, because it's natural, therefore it's spiritual. And because it's spiritual and it's one with God, therefore, so in that sense. So they're also teaching the same philosophy, that because everything comes from God, our desires come from God. Right? So they teach that.
Mm.
But the difference is this, that yes, we have the tendency to desire. So for instance, but when that, our spiritual, as I said, this lust in the Bhagavad Gita covers our true knowledge and it covers the soul. So then our desire is different. So for instance, to give an example, if a person takes intoxication, so when they're intoxicated, they still have their tendency to desire, and because we're coming from Krishna, we all have a tendency to desire. But because they're intoxicated, they may say, I have a natural desire to get in the car and drive at 100 kilometres an hour in a 30 kilometre an hour speed zone while I'm drinking more. See? So that is a natural desire when you're intoxicated. But it's not a natural desire when you're sober, is it? So, you know, so when we want to forget our original spiritual position, so we can forget to the point that I don't even want to be, you know, human being is too much responsibility. I want to forget all of that and religion and everything. Okay, become a dog. So then, you know, we have a desire. Let me run around and bark at people and, you know, eat this and, you know, some have sex on the streets and something. So that's natural because our consciousness is covered. So Prabhupada says, and he said this in Hyderabad, 1974, that he said we actually have two types of natural desire. One according to our material body, and one natural desire when we're on the spiritual platform. And that is our original natural desire. We're not intoxicated by material life or material desires. So desire, yes, comes from God. But when that desire is covered by ignorance, what is natural in that covered state,
it's opposite.
It's perverted, it's inebriated, it's, you know, covered by ignorance. So we discard that natural desire. We control that natural desire that may be there in the material body. And we try to accept just the natural desire of the soul. And that's what we learn, and that's called liberation. And that's what we're hearing here in this Bhagavatam.
Mm-hmm. What is that in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna Bhagavan says that the desires which are opposite to dharma, he is the desire which is opposite to dharma.
Do you know that verse?
I will find out.
Yeah. Think about it if you tell me. But I mentioned this verse to you one time from the fifth chapter. Do you remember that verse?
I think so.
That basically Krishna absolve Bhagavad Gita 5:15, right? That Krishna absolves himself of the of creating the material desires of the living entities. He says, "Narate kasyachit papam na ceva sukhitam bhubhu agani navritam jnanam tena muyanti jantavaha." Nor does the Supreme Spirit assume anyone's sinful or pious activities. Embodied beings, however, are bewildered because of the ignorance which covers their real knowledge. And so, the Lord himself, of course, because he's full in himself, doesn't ever desire anything foolish, but it says but the living entity, bewildered by ignorance, desires to be put in certain conditions of life, and thereby his chain of action and reaction begins. He desires to act in a certain way, and that gives a certain reaction and another set of desires. One set of desires produces another set of desires. That's the nature of this world. And so one set of actions produces another set of actions. But that's because of the living entity's ignorance. The living entity can come out of that ignorance by always hearing about the personality of Godhead. So, the Thereafter, text number 49. Thereafter, one day, while Sabari Muni, who was expert in chanting mantras, was sitting in a secluded place, he thought to himself about the cause of his fall down, which was simply that he had associated himself with the sexual affairs of the fish. Purport. Vishwanath Chakravarti the Kaur remarks that Sabari Muni had fallen from his austerity because of a Vaishnava aparadha. The history is that when Garuda wanted to eat fish, and we'll hear a little bit more of this in the pastimes of Kaliya, Sabari Muni unnecessarily gave the fish shelter under his care. Because Garuda's plans for eating were disappointed, Sabari Muni certainly committed a great offence to a Vaishnava. Because of this Vaishnava aparad, an offence at the lotus feet of a Vaishnava, Sabari Muni fell from his exalted position of mystic tapasya. One should not, therefore, impede the activities of a Vaishnava. This is the lesson we must learn from this incident concerning Sabari Muni.
Because it was Garuda who had come to eat the fish, I think it's the
natural order of things that he disturbed. Yeah, it's... Yes, Garuda eats fish. And, you know, that is set aside as his quota. Because after all, he is in the form of a gigantic bird. And of course, you can imagine those, you know, so for instance, you know, in the Battle of Kurukshetra, we see that Krishna revealed his universal form. And all the people there on that battlefield were entering into Krishna's mouths, being consumed by Krishna, crushed between his teeth like this, all being consumed. So time is like that. But that all of those personalities attained either liberation, unless they wanted to particularly go to the heavenly planets, they were still somewhat attached to this material, but at the very least they went to the heavenly planets. So Garuda, you know, he carries the personality of Godhead, who is time himself. So, you know, these fish are being consumed by the Lord's carrier, who's, you know, Garuda in one sense is non-different from the Lord on that absolute platform. He's the Lord's devotee, but because he's on the absolute platform, he's non-different from the Lord. So, you know, those fish, it's not an ordinary thing to be eaten by Garuda. You know, it's not an ordinary thing to, you know, everyone in this world is being killed. Everyone. But if they could somehow die in the presence, or in somehow or another their death is in relationship to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then that is unusual. And so, you know, these fish being eaten by Garuda, they will only benefit from that. They will immediately be promoted to the, instead of being fish, which is, you know, way down in the lower species, they're immediately promoted to a very elevated position just by being eaten. They're going to die anyway. So in fact, you know, Garuda has saved them from millions and millions of deaths. They just have one death by Garuda and millions of deaths. So that's actually compassionate in one sense. If someone says they have to die in that life, that no one can stop because they've got a body, but they also have to die in millions of other lives, But that stopped. So the one death that they can't avoid anyway, they have that, and all those millions of other lives have stopped. So, you know, it's...
Yeah, but, you know, I'm thinking more from the intent of Subbaru Muni. He was trying to save, in his eyes, an innocent creature from being killed
yes.
by a bird of prey.
Yes.
And in return, he's got punished pretty badly because he's fallen from his grace. He's used up all his mystic powers. He's going to start from scratch again.
Yes.
It just feels like it's a really big punishment in return for saving an innocent creature in his eyes. He wouldn't have seen that as disturbing the natural order. Like if we see somebody, say a wild animal is coming after a dog, for example, and I go, if I can open the door and let the dog in, I'm going to save the dog's life from that animal. Yes, agreed, I've tried to do something good, but then somebody else comes up to me and says, no, actually you disturbed the natural order of things. You'd be like, oh, that doesn't sound quite right. I was doing the kind and compassionate thing. So that's where I was just, when I heard the story the first time, I was a bit like, that doesn't make sense. But
Prabhupada says to do good, first of all, you have to know what good is. So, for instance, Prabhupada was once asked to speak at a Gandhi convention, and you know, and of course that's a meeting about non-violence, which is the same thing here. Gandhi, you know, was doing a similar thing to Subbaru Muni in trying to be compassionate, but on the platform of the bodily concept of life. And Prabhupada said in doing that, he caused the greatest violence. Because to do that, he impeded the Lord's mission in presenting the Bhagavad Gita as it is. Because he presented his non-violence movement on the basis of the Bhagavad Gita. And in doing so, he condemned, to this very day, people are condemned to the cycle of birth and death hundreds and hundreds and thousands of times, because when they read the Gita, there's no benefit. Because they're not hearing Krishna's message, they're reading someone else's message. See, Prabhupada said, if someone interprets Gita and you read that, you actually haven't read what Krishna said, and therefore there's no benefit from reading the Gita. You know, to benefit from reading the Gita means we actually have to hear what Krishna said. And if we hear what someone has said according to their material intelligence, we don't get the result. In fact, that person has done us the greatest violence by condemning us that you will not, you know, attain liberation. You'll be, you know, caught up in this cycle of birth and death for so many years. So, in effect, they're causing the greatest death. So, I was going to wait until we got to the story of Kali Krishna, but from what I understand, that because Garuda didn't go there to eat fish anymore, Kaliya came. Kaliya came after.
Kaliya, the snake?
Yeah.
The one who Krishna.
Yeah. And Kaliya killed everything. He killed all the fish in the water, you know, all the birds. It was become so poisonous that the trees died and everything. So by saving a few fish, he actually caused so much death and suffering.
But he wouldn't have known.
Exactly.
That's what I'm saying.
Therefore, for one to do good, they first have to know what good is. Krishna knows what's good, so we align ourselves. We never impede Krishna or the Vaishnavas because they actually know what good is. And if we impede the Vaishnava or Krishna, and with our material intelligence, we try to supersede the will of the Lord, which is actually the natural course of events, then we actually the so-called good that we try to do actually becomes the cause of so much problems.
So in our normal course of life right now, in Kali Yuga, how would you know if you're trying, you have faith you're doing something good?
You won't know. Basically, to do good means that we just follow Krishna's plan according to the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, and if we follow that, we know that we're doing good. And if we conceive of something else which is not in line with the Bhagavad Gita, then we can understand that we will, our material intelligence, our material desire, you know, and to create some good will only create havoc.
Who are the Vaishnavas?
What's that?
Who is the Vaishnava?
The Vaishnava is one who's whatever. If Krishna says, you know, perform yagya, you'll get rains, and Krishna says this in the Bhagavad Gita, the Vaishnava is who says exactly what Krishna says. The Vaishnava is one who just says exactly what Krishna says, the representative of Krishna, without changing. That's Vaishnava. Krishna, so they serve Krishna by just what Krishna wants, they make sure that is done. That is a Vaishnava. So, yeah, so this, you know, so therefore a devotee's only business is to make sure that, you know, in whatever they do, they're just trying to please Krishna as they've been guided by Vaishnavas. And then they're... So for instance, one time, 1968, Prabhupada was in LA. one devotee, you know, asked him, Prabhupada, we're going out on the streets doing Harinam. How do we entice people to join in and attract their attention to the Harinam, you know, because people, of course, in those days were, you know, oh, these Haris, get out of here, get up. Prabhupada said, no, we don't do anything to please the crowd or to please anyone. We only act in such a way to please Krishna. So if we go on Harinam, we just try to do nice kirtan for the pleasure of Krishna, and he says if you do that, automatically people will gradually become attracted. But you don't go out there in order to, you know, oh, let's, you know, put on a little show and, you know, get the crowd with us like that. We just do our service as guided by Krishna in order to... So when Rupa Goswami wrote the Nectar Devotion, he said, may this please Sanatan Goswami. Mm. The, you know, his, yeah, he took him like the guru, he was his brother, but, you know, the Vaishnava. If we try to please the Vaishnava, the representative of Krishna and Krishna, then, you know, he didn't write the scriptures in such a way that, oh, the people of Kali Yuga will be attracted and so on. No. If this pleases the Vaishnava and Krishna, then it will do its job like that. So, you know, this is the secret of success. So, for instance, you know, when we're giving classes or doing kirtan, and I know it's a it's this point that sometimes it gets missed, you know, so much so, yeah, I see this, that you can have very senior devotees and they won't even ask them to chant sometimes. If someone has musical ability to attract the crowd, sometimes they just get the musicians or someone with a very sweet voice or what have you, and to do kirtan. And but you know, if you look at Prabhupada, he wasn't like a 16, 17 year old young girl with a beautiful voice who can cover all the octaves and playing, you know, the harp and, you know, he was like 70-year-old, you know, and with his raspy voice and you know, banging on a tom-tom because he didn't have a madanga, and you know, they just come out of nowhere. because he was just trying to please his spiritual master. So we should never lose sight of that. But, you know, I think in many places we already have. But, yeah.
Is there any story where there's two separate Vaishnavas trying to please God but doing opposite things? Is there any such story?
Oh, yes. You know, look, Vaishnavas can have differences of opinion. To, you know, just Prabhupada explains that, you know, you can have the left and the right, but their goal, if their goal is sincerely just to purely please Krishna,
yeah,
then it doesn't matter.
So Bharu Muni had been saving those fish to please Krishna.
That's a different thing, but he wasn't, yeah. So, you know, from this we can see, one, don't offend a Vaishnava, don't engage in materialistic, compassionate work without a concept of what's pleasing to Krishna. And there is no enjoyment in the material world, no matter how expert one is in fulfilling one's desires. Alas, while practicing austerity, even within the depths of the water, and while observing all the rules and regulations practiced by saintly persons, I lost the result of my long austerity simply by association with the sexual affairs of fish. Everyone should observe this fall down and learn from it. A person desiring from liberation from material bondage must give up the association of persons interested in sex life and should not employ his senses externally in seeing, hearing, talking, walking, and so on. One should always stay in a secluded place, completely fixing his mind at the lotus feet of the unlimited personality of Godhead. And if one wants any association at all, he should associate with persons similarly engaged. Report. Sabari Muni, giving conclusions derived from his practical experience, instructs us that persons interested in crossing to the other side of the material ocean must give up the association of persons interested in sex life and accumulating money. This is also advised by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he quotes the Chaitanya Chandradaya Nadika. Alas, for a person seriously desiring to cross the material ocean and engaged in the transcendental loving service of the Lord without material motives, seeing a materialist engaged in sense gratification and seeing a woman who is similarly interested is more abominable than drinking poison willingly. The one who desires complete freedom from material bondage can engage himself in the transcendental service of the Lord. He must not associate with vishayi, materialistic persons, or those interested in sex life. Every materialist is interested in sex life. Thus, in plain language, it is advised that an exalted saintly person avoid the association of those who are materially inclined. Srila Narottam Das Thakur also recommends that one engage in the service of the acharyas, and if one wants to live in association, he must live in the association of devotees. This Krishna consciousness movement is creating many centres just to create devotees, so that by associating with the members of such a centre, people will automatically become uninterested in material affairs. Although this is an ambitious proposal, this association is providing effective by the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. By gradually associating with the members of the Krishna consciousness movement, simply by taking prasad and taking part in chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, ordinary persons are being considerably elevated. Subhari Muni regrets that he had bad association even in the deepest part of the water. Because of bad association of the sexually engaged fish, he fell down. A secluded place is also not secure unless there is good association. So here we get another, you know, Don't try to practice in this age a farcical yoga system of meditating and going into quiet places to meditate, because you'll not find anywhere more secluded than, you know, under the water, meditating deep within the Jamuna, in the holy dharm. So, you know, better to actually go to the big cities, find a big Hare Krishna temple and associate. And that is considered secluded. Secluded means you're secluded from bad association. And it is filled with association of devotees. So that is wanting. And as you can see, Srila Prabhupada, reminding the world, this is what these Hare Krishna centres are for. Very scientific. And, we see that, these Hare Krishna centres, you can have prasad, people can get married. If they need to have some sexual desires fulfilled and some association with the opposite sex, they can get married and raise children. So there's not a false repression. And they can have prasadam, they can have festivals, they can dance and chant, the men and the women they associate in service. There's so many activities, there's so many wonderful, there's the hearing and the chanting and, so many activities that the deity worship, the beautiful forms of the Lord and like that. So many service that whatever one's natural propensity is, one can work in this way, one can work in that way. There's no repression. It allows everyone to fulfill their natural propensities according to their material body and mind in a regulated way, while cultivating the eternal natural propensities of the soul. Now, this is very important, and other religious movements around the world need to take note, because I was watching a documentary the other day that, we know that within, I'm not having a go at any particular religion, but this is very topical at the moment, that one of the big problems in the last, so many years with the Catholic religion is that they have, it's been exposed that there's a lot of problems with pedophilia. Now, the next wave of, scandal, which is already rising up like a tidal wave, is that this is the next one that will hit. It's already surfacing, but like the pedophilia, it's sort of people are pushing it. It takes a lot to get it out in the open, when you're dealing with, because the churches have this tendency that the way they fight the corruption within is just to remain silent and not react to it. But they can only do that for so long. So the next one, which is coming up now, is the rape of the nuns. And what happened was that apparently when, previously, because the priests, because they can't marry, and many of them should have, 90% of them should have, 99%. They were going to prostitutes, or sometimes they'd have affairs with some of the parishioners. And then AIDS come in. And when AIDS come in, they felt, now we're unsafe doing that. So then they started to have sex with the nuns. Of course, the nuns didn't really want to have sex, and so there's rape. And then, of course, children, were conceived, and for the nun and the priest to be having sex and there's a little baby there, so that, then the priest were actually, asking them to abort the children. And even, which is completely against the Catholic religion. And then the, even there are cases where, the medical profession have documented that some of the abortions were taking place, at 32 weeks, which is illegal, even in places where abortion is allowed. So there's some very, very, scandalous activities going on. And that is because they actually have to learn from the Krishna consciousness movement how, like Ambarish Maharaj, all of one's mind and senses can be engaged in the service of the personality of Godhead, and according to one's material tendencies, those material tendencies can also be fulfilled in a way that is according to religious principles, even sex life, and therefore there's no artificial suppression, and one can gradually make advancement on a stable and more realistic platform like that. So you know, this is where, you know, the culture of the Krishna consciousness movement. Prabhupada once said that for Christianity, because there's no culture, like the Krishna conscious culture is just not there. They should be marrying. That's culture. The priest. Because the culture's not there, when the wealth reduces, it will crumble, collapse, because there's no culture. Now, Krishna consciousness is not like that. Krishna consciousness, even the wealth's not there, it still flourishes, because the culture, people just want the culture. Whether there's money there or not, makes no difference. But that day is coming, and of course, because of these scandals, people are, because of these scandals, 3,000, what to speak of the congregation, but 3,000 of the clergy are leaving every year the Catholic Church. Every year, the clergy, 3,000 a year, are leaving, what to speak of the followers. And in fact, many of the followers, if they want to follow Jesus, which, there's nothing wrong with Jesus, he's a great saint person, then they're actually having nothing to do with the church, but just in their own homes, they're following, a brand of Christianity, which they understand is, so they might have a group here and a group there, and they're, they're like that. So, it's sort of the whole thing is dissipating. When the money's gone, and as people stop, giving because they feel there's corruption there, Prabhupada said it will collapse because the culture's not there. And then they'll want culture. And where are they going to get that culture? They're going to come to the Krishna consciousness movement, that culture. These books and these temples, which are showing us how to put this culture into practice, very, very important. And we'll see that more and more as the future goes on. And I've seen that in my, very short time, as a devotee, that, I've noticed that both the government, in different parts of the world, and I'll take Australia as an example, New Zealand, the governments have appreciated, this movement has value. The people in general, this movement has value. The Hindu society, this movement has value. Everyone is appreciated. People in general, they want us chanting on the streets now. The family, the family members and the schools want to know. So people are appreciating. And as time goes by, more and more people see the value here like that. And as Prabhupada said, they have one book, the Bible, but we have so many books.
In the Bible, they have so many variants.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yes. Because the parampara system in the Krishna consciousness movement is very unbroken, very solid, and therefore the teaching is just passed on. And because people practice so others can see, here's a Vaishnava, Vaishnavi, let me do what they're doing. So if the parampara is not there, then yes, everything deteriorates very quickly. And you know, so basically, there's no real concept of serving God in Christianity. It is come down to just social work, you know, compassionate work according to the bodily concept. There's a little bit, you know, preaching the word of God, that is service to God, you know, like that. But in their practical lives, it just comes around to, you know, just looking after each other's bodily needs, you know, to some degree or another.
So I guess that shows the importance of deity worship and kirtan.
Yes.
Because those are even more than deity worship, kirtan. So that's our main form of serving the Lord.
Yes. But, you know, because a lot of people don't immediately understand the importance of kirtan, the deity worship can engage unlimited people. So like Radha Ballabha here, we can engage unlimited people in the service of Radha Ballabha in an unlimited variety of ways. Mm. And that gradually, as they associate, they gradually learn the value of the kirtan and the association of Vaishnavas. So he's reflecting. He says, in the beginning I was alone and engaged in performing the austerities of mystic yoga, but later, because of the association of fish engaged in sex, I desired to marry. Then I became the husband of 50 wives, and in each of them I begot 100 sons. And thus my family increased to 5,000 members. By the influence of the modes of material nature, I became fallen and thought that I would be happy in material life. Thus, there is no end to my material desires for enjoyment in this life and in the next. So, by bad association and also by Vaishnava Parad, he became a victim to that bad association. So that Vaishnava Parad to Garuda, so it's very important. We saw in the life of Ambarish, you know, one should understand that because, you know, even yogis like Devasa Muni and Sabari Muni, yoga means that they're connecting with the Supreme. It's because of their meditation upon the Supreme. Vishnu, that gradually they develop these great mystic powers. But here we're also seeing that, as in deity worship, you know, when people come and worship the deity, that concept is good. They understand we're worshipping God. Even if they're asking for material benefits, still it's good. Until, you know, pure love develops. But higher, the Majjhima Adhikari, those who are off the material platform by and large, the difference is that they understand the value of how to associate nicely and live in the company of Vaishnavas. That's what the temples allow a lot of Vaishnava association, but one has to elevate oneself above the material platform to be able to associate with the Vaishnavas nicely, without problem, without committing offence. That's very important, and we see here that if one doesn't rise above that platform, then the material qualities, even though one is connecting with the Lord through yoga, even bhakti yoga, our material propensities, we're susceptible, you know, that we will fall down from the position. So until we come to the point where we can actually associate with the Vaishnavas nicely, we're on the prakriti, you know, or the materialistic level of yoga, even as bhakti yogas, and the propensity to fall down is quite significant, to fall away. Falling away, and what happens, falling away means that, again, we become attracted to material things and become entangled in we become attracted and we become entangled in such a way that we become attracted in such a way we become completely entangled, and our spiritual practices become completely overshadowed by the material activity. So we're sort of increasing in spiritual interest, increasing, and then there's Vaishnava aparad, and then all of a sudden, instead of increasing, what begins to happen is our material attraction begins to come back very strongly to the point, and our spiritual activities diminish, and then we're suffering. We think, what happened? I was doing so nicely. So that's the danger. So one has to come to that point of Majjhimadikari where they very nicely can associate, appreciating that Vaishnava aparad, like the mad elephant, can cause havoc. So in this way, he passed his life in household affairs for some time, but then he became detached from material enjoyment. To renounce material association, he accepted the Vanaprastha order and went to the forest. His devoted wives followed him, for they had no shelter other than their husband. When Subhari Muni, who was quite conversant with the self, went to the forest, he performed severe penances in this way. In the fire at the time of death, he ultimately engaged himself in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Purport. At the time of death, fire burns the gross body, and if there is no more desire for material enjoyment, the subtle body is also ended. And in this way, a pure soul remains. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. Chafadiham panajan manaiti. If one is free from the bondage of both the gross and subtle material bodies and remains a pure soul, he returns home back to Godhead to be engaged in the service of the Lord. Chafadiham panajan manaiti mamiti. He goes back home, back to Godhead. Thus it appears that Subhari Muni attained that perfect stage. And as we were describing previously, that Prabhupada was mentioning, speaking that we're an atomic anu, we're an atomic spiritual particle. So small, like a little point, that you cannot see it. You can get the greatest, they cannot invent a magnifying device that will allow them to see. It is so small that will not happen. So it's like a little point. But the Srila Prabhupada explains that it does have form. And if we do become liberated from the gross and the subtle body and we're eligible to go back to the spiritual world, the soul, the spirit soul, expands into the spiritual form which is appropriate for to serve Krishna in the spiritual world. And he describes that, because one devotee asked him that, it was in New Vrindavan, I think 1976, saying, Prabhupada, if the soul has form, because, the material body, covers the senses of the soul, and therefore we can understand, Prabhupada often uses that, we can understand the soul has form because the material senses, cover the soul, therefore the soul must have form. So then one devotee asked, good question, then if the soul has form, in the form of a tree, does that mean that soul is a tree in the spiritual world? So, Prabhupada could understand that, he was thinking in terms that somehow the soul's form is fixed up. But he explained that just as the material energy, you can get clay or and you can make so many different forms from the clay, which is just a material energy. But it remains, you know, that same piece of clay, but you can make so many different forms. So similarly, spiritual energy is even, you know, in one sense, more capable, that it's a substance that, you know, the form can be modified, you know, as you can with the material energy. You know, you can... So in other words, he gave the example, just like Krishna, you know, he appears as a, you know, baby Krishna, you know, and performs his eternal pastimes in this world. So we know that Krishna's form is actually eternally his, you know, a cowherd boy playing the flute, and his, you know, his 16 years old, or, you know, that sort of youthful age. And that's Shama Shundra, that's his eternal feature. And yet, he can, you know, also have the form of little baby Krishna. So, you know, Prabhupada's given that example how spirit can be, you know, changed from one form to the other, although it's the same person, you know. So, but he was saying that, you know, when the soul in this position becomes eligible to get, then, you know, the soul actually expands into the form and appears before Krishna, forms suitable for, you know, serving Krishna. And we all, you know, generally also understand what that generally means is that first we may take birth in one universe where we're trained up and, you know, there's for our eternal service in the spiritual world, and then, you know, from there we go back to the spiritual world. So then the last verse here is that Maharaj Parikit, by observing the husband progressing in spiritual existence, Subhari Muni's wives are also able to enter the spiritual world by his spiritual power, just as the flames of a fire cease when the fire is extinguished. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 9.32, Striyo Vashastatasu Jastethi Yanti Paramgittim. Women are not considered very powerful in following spiritual principles, but if a woman is fortunate enough to get a suitable husband who is spiritually advanced, and if she always engages in his service, she also gets the same benefit as her husband. Here it is clearly said that the wives of Subhari Muni also entered the spiritual world by the influence of their husband. They were unfit, but because they were faithful followers of their husband, they also entered the spiritual world with him. Thus, a woman should be a faithful servant of her husband, and if the husband is spiritually advanced, a woman will automatically get the opportunity to enter the spiritual world. Any comments? I was waiting for a question just like that. I would have been disappointed if one didn't come. Well, you know, it's interesting because I think it's in the Krishna book that, you know, Prabhupada mentions that even more so than men, women being soft-hearted generally, naturally, you know, their sentimental nature, they're naturally attracted to religious principles and, you know, worshipping the Lord. So in one sense, women have more of a tendency than men to, you know, for that, you know, to have a, say, a feeling connection with the Lord, like that. You see, so that tendency is there. You know, Prabhupada mentions that in the Krishna book. And so, in one sense, they, you know, they both derive benefit from each other. Here, Prabhupada is saying that perhaps some of the austerities may not be as, you know, women may not be, you know, automatically attracted to perform austerities. Now, you know, that's not an unnatural thing because, you know, if women are having children and, you know, especially, you know, then they're breastfeeding the children, so they're with the children, you know, there's no need for them to be performing all sorts of austerities in the caves, in the forest, or, you know, what have you, because the natural tendency is to literally be creating comforts for the child, and of course for the ability for the mother to, you know, not become ill, or you know, to, you know, protect the material body. She's looking after, you know, the safety of a child. So, you know, that if women have, you know, a few children, and that can go for many years, and sometimes can go for the, you know, quite a long time, the prime of their life. So, you know, just because of the psychophysical nature of men and women, it's not unnatural for women to not necessarily be, you know, seeking out austerities. So these are, you know, general. Here, you know, what you're saying, Nirmala, is that sometimes you see that women are, you know, capable of great austerities, more so than men. So, you know, there are general principles, and general principles apply. Just like, you know, if we say summer is when the weather is very hot. But as you know, in the middle of summer, you can get hailstorms and then, you know, a couple of weeks of, you know, very cold. And someone says, oh, you said summer's hot. Yeah, summer's always hot. But, you know, winter is generally cold, rainy, and then in the middle of winter you get this. So you know, there's general rules, you know, which apply to men and women. And that doesn't mean that there are, you know, exceptions to that, but the general rule holds. You know, this is one of the things that we people will value from these scriptures, is, you know, people are becoming so confused now. What is the nature of women? What is the nature of men? Is there anything we can put our, you know, our minds to where there's something solid you can say this is the nature of a woman, this is the nature of a man? Everything's so mixed up, it just seems like, you know, whatever you want to be. So now they've got this thing that, you know, do we even have male and female toilets anymore? And that's the latest thing. They're worried. You know, it's like, what a problem. We don't know what a man and a woman is, so, you know, should they just be unisex and they just all go in the same toilet? Of course, you know, from my understanding of women, I've got five daughters and my wife, I don't think they'd like men listening to what's going on while they're in the toilet. You know, that'd be my general, you know, understanding. Men are probably a little bit more callous to that sort of thing. You know, I'll just have to put up with it. You know, but women tend to be, you know, a little bit more. So, but, you know, there are, at some stage they're going to get, you know, society is going to get so confused that they're going to say, just give me something to, you know, just give me something that I can, you know, relate to, that, you know, here is, you know, there is something that's general to women, you know, that to all women in one sense. So, you know, the Bhagavata, like summer, you know, we know we're having climate change. In the middle of summer, we're getting more storms and more wet, but we still get our summers. You can't say, you can't say, okay, here is spring. Oh, no, climate change. I'm going to plant my crops in the middle of winter. You know, you can't just say there's so much generalisation, everything's being clouded so much, the farmers are now, you know, I'm not even going to bother with the season, I'm just do whatever I want, you know, it's all mixed up. It's not like that. There are still generalisations, and those generalisations will always exist, despite the mixes. So, in general, Prabhupada points out that women have more of a tendency to be attracted to the sentiments of religion, you know, to love God and what have you. Men, you know, even more so than men may have, in a general sense, more attraction to, or, you know, and therefore ability to perform the some austerities. They are general things, They do hold, but there are many, many exceptions. If the husband, if the wife is more advanced than the husband, then the husband still gets 50% of that. You know, generally, according to here, that 50% means 100%. That whatever advancement the husband makes, the wife shares that equally, because she's considered 50% of the husband, and he's considered 50%. They're 50% each. Not that he's 100%, she's 50. Of 100%, 50 each. So if the husband makes spiritual advancement, the wife gets 100% of that. If the wife is more advanced on the path of bhakti, especially, and the principles of bhakti, the benefits all round in every respect apply to the greatest degree, then the husband also gets the benefit of the wife's spiritual advancement. But Prabhupada had one sister who, her husband was quite a significant rascal. Broke a lot of principles. Didn't really, you know, follow anything. He followed all the things he shouldn't have. And his sister was always very chaste, despite the difficulties that her husband created. And for practically their whole lives, he wasn't interested in Krishna consciousness. And then, as far as I understand, he did, you know, become a devotee. He you know, developed, you know, attraction to Krishna as well. So, you know, that's one example I can think of where, you know, where the woman was actually spiritually advanced and the husband had no attraction and then became, you know, came to her level by the grace of the wife. Okay. So, yeah. And there are probably, you know, many more. Yeah. Any other questions or comments on that? Yeah? So, are you finished there?
No, I just, when I was talking, I was just thinking about an example of the Brahma's wives. Is that an unusual situation?
Like the Jagyapati, Patnis?
Yeah.
Yeah, they were more advanced than their husbands.
Yeah, but it's...
And, you know, there you see that, you know, that they're, as Brahmanas, they're performing the rituals and austerities of a Brahmana, which the wives not necessarily were doing, but they were attracted to the, you know, that heart connection with the Supreme Lord, like that. So again, you know, that example of that. And they understood that their wives were very advanced. So they would have got the benefit from their wives being advanced. Yeah, is that what you're saying?
I was thinking of that example. By emotional makeup. So
yeah.
Is that the Brahmana Patis are a very unusual situation? But generally women's tendency is this.
Yeah, well, yeah, what you're saying is correct, that, you know, for women it's a little harder to get that free time if they're going to have children. You know, if they're going, I mean, when they have children, for a starter, they've got to deal with the bodily changes and the effects on, you know, their thoughts and everything. Everything becomes a little topsy-turvy for some time. And then, you know, there's the physical drain of you know, having children and, you know, recovering one's health. And then it does tend to limit the movements of a woman, you know, so whereas men may go about doing, you know, this, that and the other, it can confine a woman a lot more. So that creates, you know, it can isolate and limit and restrict a woman's, you know, if they have a tendency for religiosity and spiritual life, sometimes, you know, just the very way that they exist in this world, you know, can be somewhat restricted. So that so there's a compensation for that, that scripturally, that if women, there is that obstacle, that handicap, therefore it's compensated scripturally that, you know, in some cases, as a general rule, and, you know, especially in Kali Yuga, things get mixed up a lot more than usual, but when one takes birth in the form of a woman or a Vaishya or a Sudra, now that makes up the majority of the population. That's pretty much the majority of them. The Kshatriyas and the Brahmanas are the minority, vast minority of the population. One takes birth, women, Sudras or Vaishyas, it is because their spiritual tendencies in previous lives have been a little less. And if, and their material propensities are concomitantly a little more. And if one takes birth in the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and a man's body, it means that their material propensities are generally less. So these are general, like we're saying, summer is hot, winter is cold. You know, these are generalizations, but they hold, you know. So, but, as we can see, that on the spiritual platform, there is no consideration of one's birth, as Krishna is saying in the Bhagavad Gita, that whether one has taken birth as in the normal sense, because there may be a little bit more material attachment and less spirituality in their previous lives, therefore they've taken a certain birth, which is the normal course of things, or whether one is spiritually advanced, but for some particular reason they've taken birth in what we may consider births where one who is less spiritually elevated may take birth in. on the spiritual platform, it makes no difference, because this is the glory of bhakti yoga, is that bhakti yoga, there is no material consideration or impediment. It doesn't matter how one takes birth in this world. Bhakti yoga is enacted between the soul, not the body, and the Supreme Lord. And it means that one can take birth as a and be a very young child and engage in devotional service if one, you know, takes that opportunity. As a child, one has no knowledge. There's no academic ability. There's no, one is not a professor of this, that or the other. One has not studied the Shastras or anything. And yet someone who has great academic capabilities and intellectual capabilities, and who may have even studied the Vedas, may not, if there's no attempt to connect with the Supreme Lord in a friendly way, that great giant of intellectual abilities and scholastic capabilities has no status on the spiritual platform, and that little child who's just trying to do a little something for the service of Krishna or you know, Ram, Narayan, Vishnu, that child can understand and make rapid progress on the spiritual path, and that other person cannot. So, therefore, the material concept of whether one is a man or a woman, a Sudra, Vaishya, Brahmana, Kshatriya, born in Africa, born in Australia, born in India, born in a Brahmana family, man, woman, makes no difference at all on the spiritual platform if one applies oneself to the principles of the Bhagavad Gita and engages a little bit in devotional service. That person will make very rapid spiritual progress and realize the personality of Godhead, realize their own spiritual self. That's the actual point of it. So in this world there are higher and lower degrees that you can take birth, and those higher and lower degrees means one takes birth in sattvagun, rajagun, or tamagun. The more one is in tamagun, the less one's spiritual progress is. And the more one is in sattvagun, means their tinges of spiritual or religious activity in previous lives have allowed them to take birth in those higher sattvaguna bodies. And then there are subtle differences. So, for instance, you know, there are subtle differences that even between man and a woman, both taking birth in a sattvaguna body, or you know, in the same country, India, or what have you, there's a subtle difference. Why did one take birth in the woman's body? Why did one take a birth in a man's body? According to the Vedas, whatever the consciousness was in the past life, that little extra material detachment and spiritual progress allows one to take birth as a man. But it is a general, very general consideration. very, very general, because on the spiritual platform, if one takes birth as a very elevated, spiritually advanced person, it makes no difference what form they take, even if they're in the form of a bird such as Garuda. So Garuda, you know, what does Shrika of considering male or female, you know, and then you have Hanuman. Now, Hanuman is, you know, taking birth in the, you know, the monkey, you know, monkey platform. So one who, so in that sense, you know, when a person takes birth in the association where, from, you know, they have the opportunity from very early on, or you know, within that life, to constantly be associated with devotees, constantly associated in the service of the Lord, their birth has no real consideration, because their body is somewhat being, you know, spiritualized from, generally, as soon as they contact Krishna, their body becomes almost completely spiritualized. So you see that with for instance, in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, to clarify that point, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, 4:9, one who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, upon leaving his body, take his birth again in this material world, but attains my paternal abode, O Arjuna. So, I think it's here. So, you know, here in this purport, Prabhupada says that it says, you are one who says unto the Supreme Lord, you are the same Supreme Brahman, the personality of Godhead, is certainly liberated instantly, and consequently his entrance into the transcendental association of the Lord is guaranteed. In other words, such a faithful devotee of the Lord attains perfection, and this is confirmed in the following Vedic assertion. So here Prabhupada puts it in this way, that one is certainly liberated instantly, and consequently his entrance into the transcendental association of the Lord is guaranteed. So, in different lectures, Prabhupada has explained that, just like when we associate with devotees, we're in the association of the Lord. If we're chanting Hare Krishna, we're in the association of the Lord. If we're seeing the deity, serving the deity, we're in the association of the Lord. In one lecture, Prabhupada said, I'm just trying to think where he was. I think it was Ahmedabad. Prabhupada said, you should know this, that if you're hearing Bhagavad Gita or you're reading Bhagavad Gita, you should take it that the Lord is directly and immediately speaking to you. That's how you should take it. I'm very happy to hear that quote, because I've always there's always been from many different parts of, but just a very direct statement by Prabhupada. That's how we should take it. That just like we're hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, we should understand that Krishna is directly speaking to each and every one of us. That's how we take it. Immediately. Not that we're going to wait till our next birth. Not that we're going to wait until we become, sannyas, vanapras, this, that, or the other. Immediately, from the very beginning, you take it like that. If we're hearing Gita, we're hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, we understand that Krishna is directly speaking with us. That means that, as Prabhupada says, each and every word of the Bhagavad Gita, each and every word of the Srimad Bhagavatam is Krishna, non-different. So we're in the association of Krishna now. When Prabhupada was speaking on Bhagavad Gita, 7th chapter, how you can understand that because God is everything, therefore everyone is actually seeing Krishna, but they don't know it. That's the difference. That's the difference. One who understands the seventh chapter, then they read it. Oh, Krishna's attached. Well, I'm seeing Krishna in the light of the sun. I'm actually seeing Krishna everywhere. It's all, there's his material energy, earth, water, fire, air, mind, you know, and then the spiritual energy, the super, I'm seeing Krishna everywhere. So he sees that. Others are also seeing Krishna, just like, you know, Prabhupada would say, the atheists see Krishna at the time of death. Well, they don't know it. You know, I often thought about it, but they just see death. They don't know that they're seeing God, but they're actually seeing God. Death is God. Immortality, that is God. So we are now in the association of Krishna, and to certain degrees we realize that. And Uttama Adhikari, they're always in that state. When they leave the temple, when they leave the class, when they leave the temple, when they go home, when they go to work, when they get on the bus, they're always in that state. I'm just seeing Krishna as Uttama Adhikari. At least we should try to be Majjhima Adhikari. Try and come to that platform by nicely associating with the devotees and serving the charities. So, one who has that opportunity to be in the association of Krishna in this life, that is, you can't look at that person, as male, female, Hindu, American, what have you. You can't look at that person in that sense. I mean, externally, yes. Like we look at a tiger, and say, but if I don't want him to bite me. But externally, we don't look in that sense. If a person has been awarded that nice opportunity to associate with Krishna significantly in this life and to advance more and more on that path, that is the fulfillment of that verse, and there's every chance that they can go back to Godhead in this lifetime by completing that. That is the fulfillment of that one who understands me as my birth and activities does not take birth again in this material world. They take birth in the association of the Lord. So we're actually in the association of the Lord. It's not quite a birth in the material world. This is another way, where you get those one or two lives to finish up and go back to the Godhead. It is, we're taking birth in the association of the Lord. So, there are degrees of liberation in which that person has, taken birth. If one hasn't performed much devotional service in the previous life, by what Krishna is saying in the Gita, even though externally they may have actually taken a birth due to not enough spiritual advancement and more attachment, and they're taking birth, as the Vaishyas and the Sudras or less and etc., it makes no difference anyway, because bhakti is so powerful, it does not consider the material situation of that person. They can immediately, and we'll hear about that in this ninth canto about Maharaj Katvanga. Within 1 second, one can actually make, complete spiritual advancement. So the point that, this is the interesting thing. The point that Krishna is saying, the point that the Bhagavatam is making, which we should take, that it makes no difference of our material consideration. If we take to bhakti, anyone who wants to take to bhakti, there's no disqualification. You can immediately do it. And two, if you immediately take to bhakti in the association of devotees, serving the acharyas and follow without, you know, the rules in the sense of not committing offences, what have you, can go back to God in this lifetime. That's really, that's what we should take from it. More so than, because what happens is, generally when we hear of lower birth, instead of taking that point, what Krishna said, we become absorbed in, well, why am I a lower birth? You know? Why is being born in India considered, you know, higher birth than born in Australia? You know, I might get my nose out of joint. I like to quote that one though to, you know, to the Indian people whenever I do a program. Punya Bhumi. You've taken birth in India because you're pious. Like that. They like that. They like to hear it. Especially from an Aussie. but it's a fact. And I see it practically because, you know, the Indian families, you know, it's almost like they're demigods. You know, they actually, the families like each other. I mean, generally, you know, we have exceptions. But, you know, the families like each other. They live in the same, you know, neighbourhood, and they spend their whole life looking after each other and so many different things. And, you know, very pious sort of people. So this is very unusual in Kali Yuga. It's, you know, it's almost impossible. So in many different ways you can see. And, you know, their God consciousness is just a little scratch and there it is, like that. So, you know, it's definitely... So, you know, basically, even if you're a man born in Australia, you're actually a lower birth than all the women born in India. Isn't it? That's a fact. As it's called the land. So... You know, rather than get sort of, well, you know, let's try and work it out who's more or less, you know, because, you know, there are overlapping so many things, we should just take that point that, okay, there are higher and lower births according to one's spiritual advancement. The scriptures say that we don't understand everything, but we have to meditate upon it and take that lesson. What is that? Here, Subhari Muni, he went back to Godhead. He had 50 wives. They all went into the forest with him. They all went back to Godhead, even though, actually, they really didn't... They weren't a Subhari Muni. They were the daughters of a king. They'd never practiced yoga. They didn't do anything. They just remained chaste to their heart. That's it. That was the extent, you know. How much time do they have for yoga? How many kids do they have each? 100 kids each. How often do they go to the, you know, how many rounds they chant a day? 100 kids, imagine. I got 5. I used to have one on this knee, one on that knee, one on my shoulder, one there, one sitting on my back like that. I think I was doing well. 100. You know, I'd be like under, you know. They had manservants and female servants. Mm.
So they would have been able to take care of the necessities without their having to do it much.
Yeah, he was a good husband. But still, 100 kids. You know, I mean, even you got servants, you know, the mother, she wants to be with the kids. You know, she wants to do things with them. What's that?
Childcare.
No, not those. They didn't have childcare in those days, did they? They probably did, but, you know, they liked it. They actually had the time and the facility to. He had all these gardens. You know, Subhari Muni's gone to all the trouble to make so many gardens with all these beautiful birds and things. What, and the wives, you know, not going to take their kids for a walk in the gardens? There's gardens here, gardens there, so many beautiful. Of course they go for a walk. They're not going to say, oh, you know, let's get the servants, take them for a walk. You know, I'm not going anywhere, little brats. That's 5,000 children.
So he's even more busy than the mums with the 100 kids.
Exactly. So, but
he has to keep the 50 wives happy as well.
He does. And of course, you know, the wives are also dealing with each other. They've got the one husband, you know, and they're sort of competing with each other. So, you know. One's making an apple pie, one's making a strawberry pie, sabari, you know. So, but you can see that really they attained the spiritual benefit of going back to Godhead, you know, by the, they just got the advancement that sabari had. At that. That's the point that we take. And it doesn't matter whether they're women. It didn't matter whether they were a great yogi. It didn't matter that they were a male. You know, the point that Krishna's making, that anyone who actually takes the devotional service, somehow or another, if they can become attracted to Krishna and attached to Krishna, even through their family life, then that person gets the full result, no matter what their material situation is. That's the point that we take. Any questions, comments? So that's the story of Sabari Muni. Very nice. And so we've got... So some of the... As we're saying, every word of this Bhagavatam is Krishna, so we always try and read it all. And... So we're going to hear some of the descendants. And next week, we're going to start the pastimes of Lord Ramchandra. And of course, you know, over the next few weeks, we'll have finished the ninth canto. And that'll be it for the studies this year. And then, you know, just a little office work of tidying up, which we're going to do with what time we have left.
Prabhu, just a quick question, quick clarification. Now, in the case of Sarvarajan,
yes,
he was a yogi.
Yes.
And he was practicing, you know,
yeah,
yoga. Then at the end of the lifetime, he said he surrendered unto the Supreme Lord.
Yes.
Then how did he become from yogi to bhakti?
Yeah.
What was the connection? How he would have met some devotees or something like that? Because it is a transition.
Well, he'd certainly met Garuda.
Yeah.
but not under proper circumstance.
Yeah.
But you see here that Krishna said, this is Krishna's instruction to the yogis in the sixth chapter. Krishna says that he says text 28. Well, now he's explaining 26. He's saying, from whatever and wherever the mind wanders, due to its flickering and unsteady nature, one must certainly withdraw it and bring it back under the control of the self, with a capital S. All yoga means we are practicing to control the mind. To control the mind, we must control the senses. But yoga means we control the mind. If we can control the mind, then we can fix it on the self without wavering. That is yoga. So he's saying the self with a capital S. Generally, the yogis meditate upon the super soul. Then he says, the yogi whose mind is fixed on me verily attains the highest happiness by virtue of his identity with Brahman. He is liberated. His mind is peaceful. His passions are quieted and he is free from sin. Steady in the self, with the capital S, being freed from all material contamination, a yogi achieves the highest perfectional stage of happiness in touch with the Supreme Consciousness. A true yogi observes me in all beings and also sees every being in me. Indeed, the self-realized man sees me everywhere. For one who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, I am never lost, nor is he ever lost to me. In text 31, he says, the yogi who knows that I, Krishna, and the super soul within all creatures are one, worships me and remains always in me in all circumstances. So the teachings, Krishna's summarizing the teachings of the Vedas, and now he's personally speaking, the teaching of the Vedas is that gradually the yogi comes to the point of meditating upon the super soul, and then gradually understands that that super soul is an expansion of Bhagavan. And here Krishna, he's saying, I am that Bhagavan. And gradually the Vedic scriptures, although very confidentially speak that, you know, Krishna is Bhagavan. So basically, Devasa Muni, through his yoga practice, if you follow the natural sequence of yoga, which is coming from the Vedas, you'll gradually fix the mind on the super soul, and gradually those same Vedic scriptures guide you to understand that that super soul is an expansion of Bhagavan, non-different from Bhagavan, Lord Sri Krishna, or, you know, Ramchandra, Narayan. So that's the natural, if one follows the yogic process through to its natural sequence, that's where one will end up. And so generally, you know, a yogi who doesn't become bewildered by the trying to enjoy the material perfections of their yogic cities and tries to make further spiritual realization will come to desire at that time that the yogi, having become attracted to the super soul, desires to interact with the super soul. At that time, Krishna will send a guru, a Vaishnava, immediately. As soon as a yogi has that, you know, there's attraction, and they want to, you know, there's that, they want to serve or interact, not just meditate upon and appreciate, then the Vaishnava will be that opportunity to hear the Vaishnava. Or if they've already heard a Vaishnava, which they would, someone like Sabari Muni, in the course of the time, they will recall the Vaishnava's instructions, and at that stage it will then they'll understand. Well, the Vaishnava said it, now I understand, you know, what this bhakti is, and, you know, that this between Bhagavan, the bhakta, and like this. So, you know, the it's a natural progression, and Krishna will make that arrangement like that. But if they've heard from a Vaishnava or from Gita, where Krishna is speaking himself, and they don't engage in devotional service under the guidance of a Vaishnava, then the realization will never manifest. The spiritual understanding, the transition between understanding, the eternal relationship between the super soul and Bhagavan in the spiritual world will not manifest if they don't somehow or another engage actively in devotional service. So, and this is the point, that even they're a great yogi. So in other words, as we're saying, you know, one can be born in any birth in this world, which is considered a very low birth, but if they actually engage in devotional service, they'll immediately make that spiritual progress in their eternal relationship with Bhagavan in devotional service and be gradually promoted back to the spiritual world. Whereas a yogi, so well educated in the scriptures, so much association with sadhus, but if they don't actually engage in devotional service, that spiritual advantage will never take place. But as soon as that desire, you know, they're ripe for it, and the association of Vaishnavas is given, and they take the opportunity to hear from the Vaishnavas and follow. So here, to go back to the spiritual world, these yogis, they can meditate upon, you know, we see actually many times, there are many, I think it was Prithi Maharaj and, you know, in Mandata and so many of them, actually went to the forest and practiced Astanga Yoga and went back to Godhead. Because the difference is, so it's not as if one can't take to Astanga Yoga and go back to Godhead, but when they left their body, they fixed their mind on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan, in a mood of devotional service, in a mood of being the servant of the Eternal Personality of Godhead. So you can actually be in a state, there are many examples, I think Ikshvaku and this one and that one, so many we've read, and they actually practiced Astanga Yoga and went back to Godhead because they didn't meditate in an impersonal way, and they also made the transition between understanding that Bhagavan and the Super Soul are one, and that the original feature of the Super Soul is Bhagavan, who they are the eternal servant of. When they meditate in Astanga, in that frame of mind, they're eligible to go back to Godhead. And of course, as we know, what that means is they can actually take birth in the association of the Lord, meaning that they will somewhere, perhaps in some universe, where they're with devotees and they're associating with the Lord in the temple or personally, and they're actually engaged in devotional service and trained up in that particular way, and gradually, you know, any attachments to performing unnecessary austerities and what have you, is they're purified of that. So you see, even with the gopis, it has always fascinated me that, you know, when Krishna played his flute, the gopis who were nitya siddhas, they immediately went running to Krishna and nothing could stop them. Some of the sadhana siddhas were stopped by their husbands and family. This is Krishna's arrangement. And the separation that they felt was so intense that it increased their love and attachment to Krishna to the point where it burned up any last trace of impurity through their many, many, many millions of lives in the material world. Here are gopis associating with Krishna, and the gopis of the spiritual world still needing to burn up any little trace of impurity in order to achieve their eternal spiritual form and go back to the spiritual world. So what to speak of these yogis like Subhari Muni? You know, so then generally, you know, they will take a birth where those little traces of things that we're doing in this material world which don't fit in the spiritual world, little impurities, they will be burned up. You know, you see that even amongst devotees, that sometimes, you know, perhaps they've done some yoga in a past life, and they have a tendency to perform more austerity than they need to. And that gets purified. you perform that austerity which is suitable for your devotional service to Krishna, not for the sake of, you know, just like one devotee once asked, Prabhupada was saying that, you know, the yogi passes through once a day. The bogey passes stool twice a day, the enjoyer. And the rogi, the disease, they pass stool three times a day. So the devotee said, so Srila Prabhupada, should we try to pass stool just once a day? Prabhupada said, don't base your spiritual advancement on how you're passing stool. Now, so the thing is, sometimes, you know, our tendency to be what we've done as yogis in past life, we may still have an attraction for that, but there's no need. You know, spiritual advancement is not based upon those sort of things. So, but yes, by the Astanga yogi, you know, when they come, their meditation is on Bhagavan when they leave this world. It is possible that, you know, if they meditate, if they don't fully make that transition and they're meditating upon Vishnu, they may attain Santa Ras in Vaikuntha, you know, which is a more neutral state. So they're sort of almost there, but not quite. They can attain, you know, so it's a less intense form of rasa, you know, a little bit more neutral. You know. Appreciating the Lord and in the presence of the Lord, but not necessarily always engaged in the Lord. So that may be possible.
Krishna Prabhupada always quoted.
That the purpose of yoga is
always meditate on the super soul.
That's right, yeah. But as he says also in the sixth chapter, that then the next step is to understand that super soul and Bhagavan are the same person, and that really is the perfection. Therefore Krishna says, to confirm that's the perfection of stage, he says In the last verse of that sixth chapter, you know, well, let's read it. The Krishna says, and of all yogis, he who always abides in me, so at this stage he's talking about the full manifestation of the Absolute Truth, Bhagavan, worshipping me in transcendental loving service, who always abides in me with great faith. They have no doubts. This Bhagavan feature, this is the complete full manifestation of the Absolute Truth. They have no doubts. So great faith. Worshipping me in transcendental loving service. So they're a yogi, but of any description, but they're worshipping the Lord, they're meditating upon the Lord in devotional service. The bhakti is there, not just and is most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. So therefore, the yogi should understand that is the complete perfection. To understand, and then Krishna says, at the beginning of the seventh chapter, he gives the easy process. So Arjuna said, "Well, I can't be a yogi, you know. I'm a family man. I'm a military man. You know. So what to speak of the lady saying, oh, how can I? You know, where am I going to get the time to, you know, do this yoga? Arjuna's saying it." He says, Krishna says, "Now hear, O son of Pritha, how by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, you can know me in full, free from doubt." So he says, the yoga, and this is what we're practicing by hearing the Bhagavatam, is Krishna is saying that if you want to know the Absolute Truth, think of me, and you will know the Absolute Truth, both as Bhagavan, Paramatma, and Brahman, and all the different. You will know the Absolute Truth by thinking of me. And Krishna explains through the seventh chapter how he is the Absolute Truth. So Arjuna, you just think of Krishna, and you'll know everything about Bhagavan just by thinking of me. That type of yoga you should do, and you know him in full without doubt. There'll be no deficiencies. You know the Absolute Truth without doubt. So because this knowledge is called, this chapter is called Knowledge of the Absolute. How do we understand the absolute truth? Krishna said, by thinking of me. So, therefore, the yogi should understand that there's no... The highest perfection of yoga is to meditate upon Krishna. And in the Krishna says that if you want to know the absolute, you meditate upon me. I am the super soul of the saint. So in this way, that is the proper conclusion. And if one does that as an Astanga yogi, if they meditate upon Bhagavan, knowing that Bhagavan and the super soul and Brahman are all the absolute, you know, the full features of the absolute truth, that person becomes, and they meditate in a devotional mood, not thinking that I'm one with God, that person becomes eligible to go back to Godhead. So, and then depending upon the level of their bhakti, they may attain santaras, either in this world, they may become great sages, like the Kumaras, perfect yogis, who, you know, are basically situated in santaras. You know, they have full realization, constant meditation upon the super soul within everyone and everything at all times. But from that point of santaras, they actually then progressed to realizing that Bhagavan is the super soul, the meditating upon, and the Brahman effulgence, they are manifestations of Bhagavan. So then the four Kumaras from their santaras platform, they actually became engaged in the devotional service of the Lord and actually propagating, serving the Lord by preaching God consciousness throughout the world. So, you know, one may attain santaras, either existing as a liberated soul in this world, or one may attain santaras and go in Vaikuntha, or if one actually, like the Kumaras, from the santaras and then actually engage in the transcendental service of the Lord, then can progress to dasharas and etc. like that. So the yogis can progress through Astanga Yoga to Vaishnavism, and generally they have association at the time that crucial point where they're desiring that, you know, there's something that attraction reaches that point. Krishna sends the proper devotees, or the Lord comes himself to you know, act as guru to make that transition.
So the Kumaras are acting on Dasi or Bho?
What's that?
The Kumaras, are they acting on Dasi and the Bho?
Yes, well, you know, they're, you know, when we hear of the Kumaras, we hear of them that they, you know, in different stages of their, you know, transcendental progress, you know, from impersonalists, I think, a little bit in the beginning, and that santaras. But yes, you know, they were more attracted to, you know, active engagement in the service of the Lord, yeah. So, yeah, that's as far as I understand, yes. Yeah. You know, from Santa to, you know, to Dasya. Yeah.
And for Kanta, they are preaching.
Yeah.
They could not stay in Vaikuntha. They had to return.
Right.
So they were not qualified to stay there.
No, we were saying a couple of weeks ago that we were reading, I think, the 8th canto, right? The 8th canto, and there was that battle between Bali Maharaj and everyone was in that, and Jaya Vijaya, Lord Vishnu came in that battle. And Jaya and Vijaya were actually among his associates.
Yeah, they had extended form. They were in the spiritual.
they remained in Vaikuntha, and they also came to this world in their three births as demons. But the whole time they did that, they actually also remained in their spiritual forms in Vaikuntha as servants of the Lord. Jai and Vijay. What happened to Jai Vijay?
So
Did we?
In the third canto, when he talks about the Kumaras visiting Vaikuntha and blocked by Jai and Vijay, there's a comment in Prabhupada's purport, if you remember correctly, that because they committed the offense of offending a Vaishnava,
the four Kumaras,
that even though they achieved love of Godhead, they only achieved love of Godhead in the Shantaras, and they could not stay in Vaikuntha. So how did they progress from then that stage to Dasya stage?
Well, in a similar way, you know, Subhara Muni committed a great offence, and, you know, he condemned himself for his actions and how it made him fall. And, you know, by that repentance, then... you know, it doesn't give all details, but at least we know that much, that his repentance of, you know, what caused him to come to that situation, the Vaishnava Aparad, that he was then able to go back to Godhead. So, you know, the four Kumaras also, that's right, you know, they were not allowed to stay, and they achieved that Santaras. But, you know, whether that was the end of the story for them, I doubt it. You know, now as far as I understand, they also appeared in the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The four Kumaras. And as far as I understand, they're also there in the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And I think that's in that, I mean, Navadvittam, or something like that, and Chaitanya Bhagavata. That, we can see that they did progress from impersonalism, sandaras, what have you. That offence prevented them from going further at that particular point, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the end of their story. You know, they did appear in the... I could look it up, but I'll try and get the quote next time I come. They did appear in the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Now, to be there in the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, hearing from the Lord, it's very doubtful, you know, that, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself being very merciful, you know, it's doubtful that that offence would hold past that point if they desired to, you know, attain a, you know, more active role and more, I doubt that that's the end of their story. You know, we see in their pastimes there were progressions, and we see in Subhara Muni's pastimes there was also a great offence here. He also went back to Godhead, so...
Nimbaka Sampradaya,
yeah.
Originating from the Kumaras, right?
Yeah.
And they are worshippers of Radha and Krishna.
Yeah.
And also in the Radha Jaya Jaya Madhava Jayate.
Yeah.
Fourth line is Sanaka Sanatana Varnita Jayate.
Yeah.
So they are glorifying Radha Rani.
Yeah.
So they're different.
Yeah, so... I think that that's not the end of their progress. Yeah. 455. Let's leave it there. Any more questions or comments on that?
Is there anything more about Ramachandra's
No, we're going to hear more, leading all the way up to Ram himself.
Oh, so there is more about his ancestors.
Yeah, yeah. So we're going to hear, these are all coming in that line, and we're going to hear more up to Ram. In fact, you know, so we got Lord Ramchandra appears, makes his appearance in this chapter 10. So we've just finished chapter 6. Chapter 7 is a very quick little chapter, not a lot of purports. So within about 5 or 10 minutes, and so even the dynasty of Ansaman. So the next 2 or 3 chapters, we go through very quickly. Next week will actually be, so we hear about other, ancestors leading up to Ramchandra. Next time we meet, we'll actually be then go into the pastimes of Lord Ramchandra. We're going to hear the pastimes of Lord Ramchandra. We're not going to do it trying to understand the entire Ramayana.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to, you know, there's not a lot of purports in there. We can make some comments as we go, but a lot of it we'll go through quite quickly. We're not going to, you know, so we won't spend more than, you know, a week or so on that whole chapter. We just go like that. But so read through those few chapters leading up to that and the pastimes of Lord Ramchandra, because if you have any questions, have something in your mind, and then, you know, you can stop and ask the questions. Otherwise, I'll sort of be tending to just read through the pastimes. Okay, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Is that Radharam again?
Yes.